So here's the thing. You know, when I say, when I most of my stories are going to be, I got really angry one time and started yelling indiscriminately.
Like all good stories.
All of them. Mm-hmm. All of them. And so
soundbite.
Soundbite.
We tell stories to share the human experience.
No matter what form it takes.
Actor, photographer, theatre maker, musician, whoever is trying to be heard.
We can't stop telling stories. There's no end to them.
By telling stories, we connect to each other and create a sense of community.
This is an opportunity to share stories from a talented and diverse range of individuals, in the hope it provides inspiration and knowledge.
This is a podcast about Australian storytelling in all its forms, hosted by two Australians in the arts industry.
Welcome to the Act of Storytelling.
Hi, everybody.
I'm Nick Kane.
And I'm Lauren Bailey.
And welcome to podcast 25.
Wow, yes, welcome. Well, this is strange because I am in Bali today.
Ah, yes.
In Singapadu. And you are in Sydney in Australia. So I would like to pay my respects to elders past and present. And this totally taps into where I'm at the moment because... The point of the work we do here in Bali is that their art and their religion and their culture and their lives are all the same thing. Mm. You know, when we spoke last month to Douglas and he talked about how he doesn't consider himself artistic or creative, he dances because that's part of who he is.
Yeah.
So I'm really tapped into, I guess, the spiritual level here. That's definitely part of the work. And part of the work is also that you open yourself up to something bigger than you every time you go into the work. So when I say that I'd like to pay my respects to elders past and present on whose land we record this podcast today, that's kind of amazing for me. Thinking about where you are and paying my respects to the elders where you are and paying my respects to the spirits here in Bali.
That was very nice. I think that's a lovely start to the podcast right there. I was really wondering how we were going to get through that, but that you just explained it so well, Lauren Bailey. So I think we'll just keep that.
Okay.
Okay, well, let's get into podcast 25. Do you know what, Bailey? We're getting that far into this now that we need, like, special episodes. I can't believe I'm changing the tone so much. You just said something so beautiful, and I'm about to reference we need special episodes like Neighbours and Home and Away.
Oh, my goodness.
When they have, like, you know, Lauren saves a family from the edge of a cliff face or something like that. I think we're at that level now where we just need random podcasts that are, like, specials. 6-hour specials or something like that?
Okay. Let's put that on a backbench.
Yeah.
I was just joking.
That really sums us up, doesn't it, Lauren? That was really deep from you and I just went completely the opposite way.
It's so interesting thinking, I spoke to you just before we started recording that I feel like I'm really going into this record blind this morning.
Yes.
Because I just haven't been able to get my brain to think about things in a concrete kind of way. And knowing that I was going to be talking to you this morning, I was like, okay, so I think it'll be a really useful experience of me. I've done the work here in Bali previous years and then come back into Melbourne and gone, okay, how do I keep that now that I'm back in Melbourne? Yeah. And I feel like by talking to you, I'm thinking about how I stay open and in that place while I'm still here.
Oh, that's exactly what you were talking about earlier too. It's that connection to location too, you know. Location affects you so much. So when you're in a space like you are now, it's so easy to be swept up in it. But then when you go back to Melbourne and it's a completely different atmosphere, location, surrounding, how do you keep that centered focus and feeling that you've got now?
Which is absolutely the question that we're focusing on in the work, because I don't know about swept up, but opened and stretching out. But yeah, exactly. When I come back to cold Melbourne, and the realities of day-to-day life there. How do I continue to stretch out into that?
Yeah, because you're asking yourself different questions right now than what you might be normally asking at this time on a podcast as well, you know. So let's start with your month, Lauren. I know we've started to touch on it. You're obviously in Bali.
Yeah.
But can you tell us a little bit about where you've come from over the past month since we spoke last?
I can't remember where I was the last time we recorded, and I haven't had a chance to listen to sort of where we left off last month.
Mm. The listeners will forgive you. You know, you've been busy.
Well, it's not so much that I'm not asking for apology.
Well, they weren't going to give one.
Word up. I know that in Melbourne, what was I doing? Still thinking about the film, what we're submitting the film for, still auditioning for things. I auditioned for something like 3 days before I left that would have shot the day before I left if I'd booked it. You know, and I had a call back for that, so that was good. What else was I was working hard to save money to be able to relax more while I was here. And that thing of whenever you go on a trip, it's an ending. So everyone's like, oh, we've got to see you before you go, even if you're not gone for very long. So it kind of brackets that section of your life. Which I think is great for stepping into whatever your journey is.
Fills up quickly too, doesn't it, when you're about to leave? There's just so many things, elements that you need to get done before you leave. So I guess the focus is
things
lost
really speed up. Yeah. And now I'm here, and as you can probably hear, I just feel really open, and there's a lot of great stuff happening in my work. Anyway, sorry.
No, I'm really interested to see because I know, you know, having known you for a little while now and you've been to Bali multiple times, and just what you were talking before about how you bring back how you feel right now, which I can tell via Skype the difference in you right now, how you bring that back into your normal life. I'd be interested to see. Let's, in podcast 26, let's really explore that. And see what happens.
Another thing I should note about the work I've been doing here. Sorry, we'll get on to you in a second. We had a teacher here from Yale who's gone back to America now, but so also did some work with him. And maybe I'll talk about that next month when my brain's in the right place. Not the right place, but...
That's a good reminder.
Wherever my brain is next month. Tell me about your brain, Nick.
My brain. Actually, that is a great segue because rather than talk about things that I did last month, I want to talk about my mindset. And I know that I talk about mindset a hell of a lot, but it's just a bloody big thing in my life that I need to... I want to use the words constantly wrangle. I had this big idea. I was chatting to my life coach, who I've mentioned a couple of times in this podcast, about this idea, and I know we're talking about this in our blogs at the moment with coming of age.
Yeah.
And it really came up for me, this number 32. 32, right? When I was 18 or 19 and really starting out in the performance industry and the arts, because I was, you know, doing a bit of music before that, but to be honest, when I started to take it a little bit more seriously, I was, you know, 18, 19 coming out of school. And 32 was this magical number, this age that I said, rightio, if I get to 32 and I'm not successful, I think I'll think about giving it up.
Wow.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's interesting, 32 now, because I'm 31 for everyone out there who's playing at home.
Mm. So am I, by the way.
Yeah. Yes, youngster. Now I'm getting into that final 6 months before I'm 32. This anxiety set in. And I had to really question what that was about because I was like, whoa, hold on. Because my whole perception on things has changed since I was 18 or 19, right? 32 does not seem like a crazy, ridiculous old age anymore. When I was 18, maybe it did.
Yeah, I wish someone had told me when I was 18 that 10, 15, whatever years from now, I would feel so young.
And this coming of age thing, which I know Erica touched on this, like what is coming of age? I certainly don't want to give anything up. Now, do I consider myself successful? In many ways, yes. In other ways, maybe not. But 32. It's ridiculous. And why was I feeling this anxiety? So this month has been about working through that, especially because I've had a month this month where I felt like there wasn't a whole heap going on for me. So I mentioned last month a theatre project that I was hoping to be involved with. That didn't go ahead. But as the universe would have it, another opportunity popped up and I'm in discussions with that. It's always a way, isn't it? There's some kind of weird force when you start discussing things.
When you open yourself up to something, you change from people can't see my hands. Instead of having a concentrated, narrow focus, you open yourself up to something, and because you're in that place, other things can open up and things can happen that could never happen.
And that's a really great conclusion to my month as well, in regards to 32. I'm now not looking as an end point. You know what I mean? I'm looking at as an opportunity to go, well, what's beyond 32? That's kind of exciting. You know, now that I know that I don't want to put a full stop at the end of my...
I say for the record, we're still very much in 31, right?
Yeah, we're very much in 31, but it's the it's the impending 32.
But it's not even impending. It's miles away.
Well, 6 months. Anyway.
Well, it sounds like, we're just touching on the surface there of a lot of really deep stuff that's been going on for you. That's exciting.
And talking about touching on the surface of a lot of deep stuff.
Very deep stuff. mind explosion.
It's a great word to use. Welcome to The Guest for Podcast 25.
The very marvellous and intelligent and wild and wonderful
Amy Gray.
We are here today in a hip little flat in Melbourne with the marvellous force of nature writer and broadcaster Amy Gray.
Hello.
Hello, Amy. We are in this wonderful flat in Carlton. Can you tell us a little bit about this flat and its creative significance to you?
Well, I call it the Monkey Grip Manse.
okay, tell us a little bit more about that.
Which is after Helen Garner's story, Monkey Grip, because, you know, single mum. Uh-huh. Bad decisions, all that sort of thing. It all goes together. But I am a full-time writer, so one of the reasons I probably became a full-time writer was because it was a very deliberate rejection of socialization and dealing with people every day. Yep. So it's really great to have you in the apartment. Here
we feel really welcome.
But, you know, so I work here every day and, you know, this is, you know, around this $30 table that I picked up from Facebook.
Sturdy, sturdy.
Very sturdy. I bash away at all my little projects.
Well, that is fantastic. And we are going to ask you a lot of questions in the next
45 minutes.
But to start off with, we might get you to read your story.
Oh, yeah. All right, so I was obsessed with writing from the get-go. It just took a while to get the courage to share stories and then watch how people reacted. And I never had mentors until recently. I had an informal mentor, Jenny Diske, who died in April. But it's generally just been me bumping around in the dark. The only thing of note to tell you is that when I was a child, I got into a fight with my grade 3 teacher. And I remember standing there and thinking, one day I'm going to know more fucking words than you and I'm going to beat you down. So
you three.
Yeah. Some would call that a personality disorder. Others would call it a call to art. That sort of progressed into thinking about how when women or women's stories, you know, that were sold in popular culture are often written by men and with, you know, little understanding of what it is to be a woman. And that's if a woman is featured in the story at all. And yet when women write about their lives, it gets marginalised. It's shelved off into quote-unquote women's interest or chick lit or just given the thumbprint of being niche somehow. And it doesn't matter if we write about politics or the home or any other issue. It's just seen as an offshoot of everyday, serious, credible discussion or art. You know, men's stories are accepted as of interest and importance to everyone, but women's, it's only for women.
So I embrace women's stories and write my own, often using my life as a foil to explore larger issues. And much of this actually harks back to the 70s when feminists used consciousness raising, where women told stories about their lives to understand the politics and the oppression at play. And so everything in life to me relates back to politics. And, you know, there's politics in how we work, how we eat, how we look at the world, how we live, how we fuck. You know, everywhere is the glimmer and churn of politics. So I use consciousness raising and journalism to explore this. And I still think it's a relatively radical act for women to stand up and share their stories, particularly if it screws with the gendered ignorance and stereotypes perpetuated in the media. So for me, the act of writing is just as political as the topics I cover. But writing isn't just confined to books or articles. Storytelling, even if it's your own story, won't be confined to print alone. You can tell stories on the radio, in speeches, social media, a whole variety of ways. The beauty is that storytelling can be at once individual and collective.
Wow.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
So that's the interview. Yeah. Thanks for sitting down with us, Amy.
It was a wide-ranging story. It was fantastic.
And goodbye.
Goodbye.
So you say that you were obsessed with writing from the get-go.
Mm.
Do you think that was an organic internal desire, or was your desire to write influenced by your family, as in did your parents set an example creatively for you to follow?
That's really interesting. I've got a whole chapter about this in a book that I'm currently writing, and what I found was that it was actually, there was a really strict gender line in that all the men were actually natural storytellers, which in Australian parlance often means bullshit artists. Yeah. And you know, they were. But there's this really big thread or vein of telling stories, of repeating the family stories. Mm. And every family has this, and they have it for a reason. And this harks back to time immemorial. You know, you have stories to give you a cultural education, not just in the world or in your town or in your street, but in your family. This is our tribe. This is where we've come from. This is how we act. And so that's very much, I saw there was this big performance of storytelling. Mm. It came from the men. The women were very secret in what they said, and their stories were a lot closer in focus. Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, I definitely came from storytellers. It's just that they didn't write them down.
And you said a little bit earlier off air that you came from Mount Waverley?
Yeah.
Correct, in Melbourne.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you think growing up there influenced that particular family storytelling, that sort of, let's say, I know you mentioned it might be country kind of back in the day, but, you know, it's a little bit inner city in regards to that focus. Do you think that skewed the way that the stories were told, maybe more than if you grew up in the country, let's say?
My family is actually really, really wide-ranging in terms of geographical location. So interstate, inner city, outback, country. So
you've got a bit of everything.
Yeah, and so then when they all come together, it's actually not, I come from like insanely dysfunctional, drunk, austere Irish stock.
Mm.
So fuck the location. It's about the tribe. It's about loyalty. Yeah. And so the storytelling that we kind of used to have wasn't so much fixed in location. It was more fixed on the tribe.
Yeah.
So it was that kind of floating sentience to
especially
it all.
Especially when you've got a bit of everything that comes into the family.
Exactly. Yeah.
So you're surrounded by a family where the men tell a lot of stories and pass down a lot of stories. Your own contribution, beginning to write stories down. When did that start? I'm picturing with a little baby-sized quill and cigarette.
Yeah, little baby. Well, actually, funny story is that I was taught to smoke when I was 4 years old by my mum, who was drunk and bored in a caravan park. And she taught me how to blow smoke through my nose.
Okay.
So
there's a little snapshot for you.
Hey, isn't that sweet? Why doesn't that ad kind of pop up in, like, you know, nappy ads or things like that? Like in little cute moments, the first that parents share with their kids. But anyway, bygones. I started writing by hand in my bedroom by myself. I would hide in my bedroom all the time. And I would write stories there. And then for some reason, somehow, you know, I was the youngest of three girls. And so, you know, there's a real magpie mentality there as well, where you can hoard what you can and you steal a little bit of it and all that sort of thing. Yeah, and somehow I came across a typewriter. And so I would type out stories. And so I would write my own stories that way. Wow. And then my godmother, who was of a kind of related drunk Irish tribe, decided that she would pay me to write out her uni essays for her and things like that. And so I would actually, that's how I actually learned how to write stories. That's how I learned how to form arguments, because I would type out her work and learn from that. Yeah. And then I would want to pretend that I was a writer. So I would then go and get a novel and start typing that out. But because I had really like mad rat bag storyteller family members, like I had, like my parents were actually quite straight. My mum really loved Vidal, Gore Vidal, and my dad really liked Norman Lindsay.
And for the less learned of...
So Gore Vidal was an American writer who wrote a lot about America's history. He also wrote a lot of transgressive, gender, sexuality fluid pieces that scandalized America at the time. And then my dad used to, you know, read Norman Lindsay, who was very much an Aussie, you know, pretentious, you know, ragamuffin from a very big art dynasty family. And he wrote a lot of, you know, kind of naughty stories, painted naked women, things like that. Mm. So that was their approach. But then I had these two mad uncles by the name of Cave Thing and Dudley, obviously not their real names.
No.
And they would send me books to read. And so, and I was like young and impressionable and, you know, I wasn't really connecting with my parents, my nuclear family. So I had these two who... actual drug addicts. These were drug addicts who really loved and adored me. And they'd send me Kurt Vonnegut books.
Yeah, oh, right. Awesome.
They would send me Freaked Out Furry Brother books, like comic books, because they were literally like those characters. And so I would get a lot of that sort of stuff and then I would type it all out and I would learn how to write stories from that. And then I'd be listening to radio all the time. So I would listen to Triple R a lot. And the way that they spoke. And so this is the other thing. It comes back to that oral tradition because what really unlocked it for me was listening to how different DJs spoke. And the way a really good, if one really spoke well and interestingly, I was like, ah, how okay.
That can bring you in.
Yeah. And their voice. That, that's what it comes down
and
to.
And so then I would pretend to be them for the next month and I would write in their voice. And then it was like, what works? What doesn't work?
It's always the aunties and uncles too, isn't it? That it just
leads
you down
great.
A different path.
Yeah.
Look, I can't go past this story, and you mentioned it a little bit earlier, but the fight in year three with your teacher.
Yeah.
Can you go into a little bit more detail on this? Because I feel like this is a juicy little detail.
I was, well, look, it might surprise people. I would continually get into arguments with my teachers. And so this was just one of many. And so in grade three, you know, I was telling my teacher, my uncle says that we're related to Wills from Burke and Wills. Isn't that interesting? She's like, no, no, you've obviously misunderstood. Your uncle was, you know, just looking at me. He's like, probably drunk. And, you know, because, you know, and that was all a bit of a lie because she was used to me bringing in to show and tell these really long letters that my uncle would send me when he was tripped out on acid.
Oh, wow.
And so I have these pictures. I actually have one of them and I'll grab one of them because I've got it framed because it was like a really big moment for me. It was like he would draw all these pictures in like the most finest cross-hatching that you can really only do when you're out of your gourd on acid. And it's just a particular thing.
Yeah.
And he would draw all over it and then when it was all crammed with pictures, he would then write little stories to me. Like just little snippets about what was happening in his life and things like that. And
I can only imagine the effect that would have on a child's imagination.
Yeah, we're talking
just
year
those
three.
Little moments of different stories.
Yeah.
But this was a really, really lucky thing because I'm living in Mount Waverley. It's incredibly staid. I don't have a happy childhood. I'm, you know, a confused little kid. And I get, they're almost like, you know, care packages, these amazing transgressive letters from, you know, two drug addicts and then my, you know, drunken, incredibly inappropriate grandfather who I called Popsicle Head, who would start, who would write to me in the finest, nearest copper plate, and go, hello, little leprechaun. Your very welcome letter to hand tells me that you have caught the travel bug and would like to travel the world. Well, let me tell you, the POMs are terrible. And then would go through and pretty much, you know, give you like a list sheet of hate crimes. But I would get these amazing letters and they would fill me with ideas, and then I would go into the classroom and I'd say, hey, my uncle says that nuclear war is bad and I was related to Wills from Burke and Wills, and catgut is made from, on violins is made from cats. And it's like, sit the fuck down, you're a crazy kid, you don't know what the fuck you're talking about. Yeah. And so then to me it was like, yeah, you seem like a bit of a dick. One day I'm going to be able to talk around you, because you learn that communication is power. Mm. And so then what's the ammunition? The ammunition is arguments, the ammunition is words, and then as you discover later on, there's ways to structure those arguments, there's ways to motivate and influence people. Mm. And so it's really been...
And before we get that, before we get more into talking about the ways that you use words to inform and manipulate.
Mm.
I did read during our research that you did some training as an archaeologist.
Yes.
Was this ever a legitimate alternative career path to you?
I really considered, I really, really, really considered actually being a proper archaeologist, like out there in the field, academic career. I am incredibly affectionately obsessed with Neanderthals. It's given me no end of relief that people now understand that they were soft, beautiful people. I adored them. But at the same time, and so this actually draws a little politics into it as well, it's actually a really sexist field.
Yeah, okay.
You were dealing with, like, the year before I started, the the head guy teaching archaeology was holding chutes in strippers, strip clubs, things like that.
Really?
But I only had two switches back then. One was quiet submission, and the other was blitzkrieg, and so I knew blitzkrieg wasn't going to help me. And so I would just sort of thought, you know what, this is getting to a point where it's not for me.
Yeah.
This is, and I'm not getting to do the actual work that I wanted to do.
Mm. Isn't that amazing how teachers can really shape the choices that we make? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Good and bad.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm. And it's interesting because obviously you chose being a storyteller over being an archaeologist.
Yeah.
You mentioned as well that it took a while to get the courage to share stories. Do you have a specific moment where you went, no, that's it, I'm ready to do this?
I had always been far too shy to, share stories, because I was absolutely, and even studying anything relating to it, because I was just too afraid. I thought that my work was crap and everyone would know, and then I'd be laughed out, and then, my life would be over, et cetera, et cetera. I have really great coping mechanisms, obviously. But when I left archaeology, I left it to very specifically work in the internet industry.
Okay.
And that's because I was pretty much obsessed with the internet already, and I just wanted someone to pay for the access. Not joking.
No.
And so I got into that, and so I used to trial, lots of new platforms and things like that. I had a blog, but my blog was, this is early days, my blog was actually just raw HTML that I would teach, that I had taught myself, and then I would upload the notepad file. Just I'm totally dating myself there. But and then I moved on to Blogger, and then to different formats. But so I blogged away for years before social media. And so I essentially viewed my blog as an exercise book. I didn't publicize it. Mm-hmm. I did not anything. And then what happened was, around this time, people would just sort of say, you are a writer. And I was like, well, I'm not doing any writing, motherfucker, so. But people kind of knew, and they would kind of try and edge you towards different things that would help you in that way. But what happened was, one day, Catherine Devenny had been sacked from The Age because she had tweeted about Bindi Irwin at the Logies and had made a relatively off-colour joke about her on Twitter.
Yep.
And I thought, oh, well, this is a really great writing exercise for me. What can I write in an hour? Because I like to time myself and mm-hmm. see what I can do. And so within an hour, I wrote a really quick piece about her sacking and what that meant both in terms of social media and public interaction with writers
mm-hmm.
and what it meant for media ownership and whether that ownership extended to a writer's social media account.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, got it up within an hour and it went viral. The ABC started following me. Jonathan Green started following me. And at the time, he's currently editor of Meanjin, but back then he was the editor of The Drum. And he got in contact with me when I was ranting one night on Twitter, like literally ranting, just like, like, you know, the end, you know, just the end of, like, you know, James Joyce novel where it's used stream of consciousness. Mm. It was even less.
Which is generally Twitter.
Yeah, that is, it is. Yeah. And it was just, it was tuned into mine. He was like, you should write about this piece, you know, that you're going on about, which was, I was talking about feminist porn. Or a feminist reaction to porn. And I mm-hmm. love porn. And this feminist didn't. So I wrote a piece about it. And mm. And that was my very first op-ed that got published. And I kind of sputtered a little bit every now and then writing pieces publicly. And often what would happen would be that I would write a blog post. It would end up somehow with a link on Twitter. And then everyone on Twitter would do the work for me.
Yeah.
Let's look more specifically at some of your other writing.
Mm.
How to Be a Vampire.
Oh, yes. That was just
by
after
Amy
that.
Gray.
Yes.
One of the greatest titles.
A book on some of the juicy perks of eternal life and joining the decadent realm of the vampire.
I get told by people to not mention this.
Who?
Should we?
Oh, no, let's do it.
Oh, yeah. Awesome.
Oh my God.
Say, Who are they?
Is this the book that you referred to in your Q&A for the Signal Express in 2013 when you said that your first book was actually a really good introduction because it melted the romance of writing right out of me?
Mm.
It was a great boot camp to understand that waiting for muses and inspiration are sometimes luxuries you can ill afford.
Yep, absolutely. The muse is just an absolute bullshit notion that people say to excuse the fact that they're not sitting their asses down and fucking writing. Mm.
I love that concept because I feel the same as an actor sometimes. You sit there and go, oh, I need this inspiration. And it's like sometimes you just need to bloody sit down and do the work.
Yeah, it's like someone saying like, oh, I can't run. Well, walk, motherfucker.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you'll get somewhere. To the point to running.
And so how did this whole... two questions. How did this book come about? And, you know, 25 words, how do I be a vampire?
Okay, so So here's the thing. You know when I say, most of my stories are going to be, I got really angry one time and started yelling indiscriminately.
Like all good stories.
All of them.
Mm-hmm.
All of them. And so
Soundbite.
So that's what was happening.
Yeah.
I had been to see... Twilight we're in the cinema with my housemate and like some like 14 hours later I was still sufficiently angry about it that I went to work and I was still yelling and I was like, ah, they don't understand there's this amazing tradition and canon of vampire lore, fuck them all. I mean, like, and I've got to say, like, I am a little bit of a purist. I am the person who almost walked out of Francis Ford Coppola's version of Bram Stoker's Dracula because he switched a lot of the characters needlessly. Yeah. Also, Keanu, what the fuck?
Fair enough.
We're with you. Yeah, I love vampire lore. I think it's really amazing. And it's something that actually really speaks to the archetype of myth. So this is where the archaeology background comes out.
Yeah.
Because archetype, universal stories, these are universal things that we have in our psyche that we want to understand. And we come to these... you know, pretty common stories. There's a vampire in almost, there's a version of a vampire in almost every mythology in the world, including Indigenous Australian.
Yeah.
So anyway, I was yelling about that and, you know, before I woke up in a cell without my shoelaces again, someone was on Facebook and his friend was a publisher and they said, does anyone know anyone really, like, ranty about vampires? And they put two and two together, bless them. And And then someone said, well, do you want to write this book? How do you see it happening? It's like, well, what these fuckers all need to understand is that it's not all fucking glittery fucking vampires. Rah, 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 rah. And so it was pretty much trying to give them a background on the amazing mythology that was there, rather than this emotionally abusive Christian abstinence tale spun by, you know, some trashy writer. Yeah. And, you know, it's like, hey, yo, you may have liked this book. Anyway, here's Bram Stoker. Or, hey, you know, sure, why not listen to Bela Lugosi's Dead? If you like that film, let's watch The Hunger. It's really great when you get 14-year-olds to watch The Hunger. But, yeah, so...
Wait, I don't...
Yeah, I haven't seen The Hunger.
What the fuck is wrong with you both?
Well, I don't know. Sorry. I didn't realise there was something...
Catherine Deneuve.
Really? Should we...
David Bowie. Young Susan Sarandon. Oh.
We will go and get it now.
Movie night.
No, like seriously, it is like the most beautiful... And oh, so there's so much to that story. But one of the more interesting little tidbits is that The Hunger was actually written by a dude called Whitley Strieber. Whitley Strieber then...
That's a great name.
Yeah, no, exactly. American writer. Whitley Strieber then went on to, you know... had some kind of form of writer's block, and he went on to write about how he had been abducted by aliens.
Right.
Which was, and he said it was all real and all that sort of thing. And anyway, so, you know, look, go watch The Hunger. It's amazing. And,
well, you touched on a few points there. I'm gonna pull out one specifically.
Yeah.
And it's around storytelling
and
good storytelling, because... Once again, you know, you've mentioned a few versions of vampires and especially Dracula, even if you look at that. There's been multiple versions of how Dracula's portrayed.
Mm.
What do you believe good storytelling entails?
Well, okay, so when you're looking at Dracula or when you're looking... Okay, what you're actually asking me is not specifically about Dracula.
It's not.
What you're asking about is myth. And so if you're writing about myth... You then go to Joseph Campbell, Hero of a Thousand Faces. And so that's the archetypal journey of the hero.
Yes.
What people want with their myths are to hit the notes. You have specific notes that you have that must be hit for the audience to actually feel a sense of completion.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Now, these are the basic bones of storytelling that we've had back from Greek dramas all the way to today with things like The Matrix, Star Wars, things like that. Mm-hmm. Everyone uses these same beats.
Mm.
You have a central figure who tries to run away from a challenge and then is forced back into it and then fights a big bad guy and somehow brings back something great for the population, their local community.
Mm-hmm.
So... there's, you know, then you can play with themes within that, and that's where things get interesting. So where I disagree with Twilight is that you have someone who has a very big religious agenda and has a fundamentalist religion that I don't agree with, and who actually is on record as saying that she dislikes vampires because they're too gory and visceral and things like that. So you've got them with stone cold blood temperatures. They shine, but they're very distant and removed.
I believe
and
they sparkle. Don't
I'm
they?
Sorry, that's yes, right. They right. sparkle. They it's sparkle, nice. and you know, there's nothing icky or bad or, you know, anything like that. So whereas the human nature really wants a lot more than that.
Like our shadow self. We need to recognize the shadow self.
Yeah.
And if you color it up, it's sparkle it up, it's gone.
See, my theory is that Twilight is actually not a vampire tale at all. It's a modern romance, but the central protagonist, you've actually got a threesome happening with Twilight, and it's not the vampires or whatever.
Mm.
It's capitalism, and that's because if you actually read these books, which I did for that vampire book that I ended up doing, all of it goes into meticulous detail about how much everything costs, and not in a Andy Warhol diary kind of way. It's just there's a real slavish love of products, cars, things like that. There's meticulous detail.
Real materialism. Mm.
And so then when you see, like, you know, fan fiction like 50 Shades of Grey, which is how that started as a response to Twilight, the same thing is actually at play.
Mm.
And if anything, just expanded on.
Yeah.
Yeah, wow. I think the new tagline for Twilight has to be capitalism, a threesome. Does it? Like, I'm just
threesome.
An idea. Yeah. I'm spitballing here.
Yeah, yeah. It would work.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've got quite serious here about the keys to good storytelling. And while we're on a level of... Is seriosity a word?
No, it's not.
Of seriousness.
Yes.
Between conscious... Between.
See, lucky we've got you here. That would have just got through.
Oh, no, exactly.
We only get experts.
For our own benefit.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we can learn. That's what this is all about.
That's right.
Yeah. Between consciousness raising on the profit margin of IVF and a strong focus on sexual assault and abortion rights, as well as a number of other topics that are, I guess, confronting women today, you cover some pretty important things in your work. In your 2015 article for The Guardian, Dawn Fraser and Pauline Hanson prove old white women can be as silly as old white men, which I just love as a title. I'd just like to point that out. You point out that Fraser and Hanson are shining beacons of gender equality, shattering the glass ceiling of stupid commentary. And that, unfortunately, while many have raised concerns about women making such embarrassing comments publicly, if you think about it, the mere appearance of two women in public is actually a win for feminism.
I was really pissed off that day.
How important do you feel humour is as a tool in your writing?
It's really important, if only, and I think sometimes, like at one point I had a daily news column that Andrew P. Street handed down to me, and humour became really important there, and also in the pieces that I would do for The Guardian, just because you've got quick turnaround, mm-hmm. and you're so angry about it that it's either I'm going to sit here and impugn someone and call them, you know, every name under the sun for like 30 minutes and 500 words, or I'm going to try and find ways to actually make my point with humour.
Mm.
And it's easier to make your point. It's a little bit harder to make your point with humour, but it will actually sit in people's minds for longer.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I guess as in terms of acting or just, you know, being a comedian in my everyday life,
yes,
I often think about comedy in terms of how the audience will receive it, but you talk about it there as if it's all that it's also so much about actually being able to communicate in the first place. You know, it's a tool that actually helps you
and engage
get
the reader.
Story out. Right. But it's the out as well as the in. Like it's not just about engaging the reader; it's being able to allow your voice in the first place. Yep.
Mm. Yeah, and so that is part of it. It's a way of actually because. This is something that we don't actually often talk about, but it's something that's becoming more and more known with studies, and it's pretty heavy, so we'll just deal with it very quickly and then we'll move on. And that is that writers, especially ones who, you know, cover certain topics, expose themselves to trauma. And it's the sort of thing where you'll find a lot of war reporters or even like war, you know, even reporters who aren't out embedded on battlefields or things like that, can develop PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder because what they do is they're sitting there confronted with trauma after trauma after trauma. So how do you deal with that?
Mm.
You have several ways to deal with it. And my whole approach has been, what am I going to do? I can't just be the earnest person shouting like Cassandra and no one's going to listen to me. That's great. There's a history and there's a precedent for that, but it's not going to sit in people's heads. If I use humour, it's a way of actually letting them in on something that actually is traumatising, and you want to let them in on that traumatising topic because you want to actually really talk about it with them.
Because it's important to be having this conversation. Sorry, Nick.
I was just going to jump on that because to get a little bit more personal with that, we talk about the unspeakable. And in a recent interview you did with the author Julia Lee for the ABC, you quote her as saying, the beauty of literature is that you can speak about the unspeakable. Now, in regards to getting personal with that, and if we look at that from your point of view, what's an example of something that's unspeakable that you feel like you've only been able to address through writing?
The moment I became completely affirmed as a writer was when I told something that was completely unspeakable.
Okay.
And that was when I wrote about my sexual assault as a kid. And I talked about the kind of cycles of abuse that spin out from there. And so from my perspective, that was when my parents weren't really skilled up on what it was, like many parents weren't back in the 80s. Yeah. And so they didn't handle it spectacularly well. And that actually really ingrained the trauma for me more so than the actual assault. And so I talked about that, but then I talked about why it was important to actually engage with public discussions about sexual assault and things like that, because in doing so, you educate people, you confront the truth, you confront the ugly things that are happening, and you destigmatize it, and you really engage with it. And when you really engage with something, you then break down those cycles. And when you break down cycles, you break down trauma, you lessen trauma. Yeah. When that got published, my parents disowned me. And I heard from them a little while later. I heard via like a third party a little while later. And I don't know if it was like officially from them or it was them just trying to find a compromise. And they said something like, well, what if you gave up writing?
Ooh.
You know, your family would have you back then.
Yeah.
Now, I wasn't writing full time at this point. Writing was just a hobby. And it was just like...
I reject that.
Yeah. Who would?
Yeah.
But it was this clarifying moment for me, which was I could choose that or I could choose writing. And I wholeheartedly choose writing.
There's not much of a choice, really, deep down.
Sure. No. No, you would be surprised how many people would actually go, you know what, my bad. I won't do that.
Being asked to make that choice is the choice.
It's interesting, just to jump in there really quickly, is we had a journalist on maybe five or six podcasts ago. Yeah, his name's Richard Baker.
From the Age.
And he spoke about the night before one of his articles is released. And obviously, you know, some of these articles have been, you know, big news. The night before that particular article was released, how were you feeling? Like, was it a similar sense of nervousness and this is about to happen?
It was because I was really naive and I just sort of thought that my relationship with them was okay so that they wouldn't be upset. They would just sort of see it for what it was, which was part of the progression. They could see all the love that I put into that piece and all the love that I spoke about for them. And they'd be able to understand it. So I didn't actually expect any blowback. But then when it happened, I sort of thought, oh, well, fuck you.
Yeah.
You know, I don't actually care. And so that thing actually gets back to the crucial part of storytelling and the importance of representation in storytelling, which is we actually don't hear women's stories a lot. Yeah. It's relatively new to actually hear women's stories. Mm. And that's, like, in terms of... like women's own stories, it's really, really rare. Like you can count on one hand the amount of female writers from Rome. And the reason why you can count on one hand...
Well, you could count them.
Okay, I can count it in Latin. Yeah. But
I'd still need one hand. Yeah. Wouldn't get through as many fingers. Yeah.
But even then, we don't know.
Sorry, I don't mean to joke about that.
No, that's all good. Yeah. No, but like the only reason we even know is because some men then wrote about what the women wrote because, you know, a lot of their work doesn't still exist anymore. Yeah. So women's stories are actually radical political acts to me, and the reason why we have so many unspeakable things is because there haven't been enough women sharing their stories.
Which leads really well into what I was going to ask you about next.
Mm.
The concept of feminism.
Yeah.
Has been knocked about a fair bit in the last few decades.
Yeah, very much so.
That's understatement. Yeah. Understatement zone. You mention the 70s when feminists used consciousness raising to tell stories about their lives, to examine politics and oppression. I'm really curious, in your view, if you said there were five women in Rome. Like, has feminism and has the presence of women's stories in society, have we come very far since the 70s, or have we actually regressed?
we've come far, I think, to a degree. We haven't, so, you know, there's this theory within feminism that there are generational waves. Okay, so during the 60s and 70s, they're called second wavers. They're the second wave of feminism, where the first wave were the suffragettes.
Yeah.
Okay, and so the second wavers had a very specific view of what life was and, you know, how they wanted liberation to occur. That changed and differed during the, you know, the 90s or, you know, early thousands more so, like, and you had third wave feminism. And we're kind of broaching into the area of fourth wave or Tumblr feminism, that sort of area.
What was that, fourth wave?
Tumblr.
Okay.
Oh, so, yeah, you know, so it's another area for consciousness raising, yeah, really. And so consciousness raising is where you sit down and you sort of think, everyone sort of thinks, capitalism doesn't affect me. Or, you know, some structure doesn't affect me. But, okay, well then, how about you tell me a story about money, the, you know, how money impacts your life. And suddenly you're hearing stories about someone working minimum wage for 50 hours a week and then they go to a second job because, you know, there's no protections for them, that, you know, so they have to work all that extra time because there's trickle-down economics at play, etc. So it's helping them understand their place in the world through storytelling, but through telling their stories and then seeing how their stories fits into the world's stories. And so with feminism, what's happened is those stories are reaching groundswell, both in an academic sense, but in this kind of collective story sense. So feminism's really interesting for the fact that it's both academic and it's an ideological movement of stories. And what's happening now is that the stories are actually getting to a real crescendo, but it's dangerous because people have learnt that they can profit from them.
Mm.
And so then that then affects representation of those stories because they're only going to show the stories that sell when you only...
Oh, wow.
Yeah, wow. Yeah.
Okay, before we get to that, I went to... I guess part of the reason I ask is because I feel like in the entertainment storytelling arts industry at the world that this is becoming more and more of a conversation and that we are people are committing to, you know, by too many years for it to be like it's ridiculous. By 2020 we will have this many women doing this and it's like why does it need to be that far? That's not what I'm bringing up.
background.
Trying to contain this. Yeah. But I feel like it is a topic for conversation. I recently went to a school reunion and I went to a private girls' school. And at the reunion I was having a conversation with a couple of the girls and who are doctors. And I was talking about, I can't remember what they asked me. We'd had a few drinks, I admit. But they asked me something about the industry I worked in and I talked about how I had worked on this story and isn't it great how women's stories are becoming more common in popular media, blah, blah, blah. And they're like, oh, really? Are they? We don't feel that way at all in science. It's still a dead topic. And, you know, like this is like the world's smallest sample of any experiment ever. But, you know, it just made me think, oh, no, I feel like we're moving forward. But maybe that's just
we're only moving forward with a particular area of stories. And so when you get into the really interesting area of science communication, and there are some really highly skilled science communicators out there, the thing that actually really drives them spare is that why aren't people covering modern day scientists? You know what? There have been amazing female scientists since Marie Curie. It's just that we treat women as such tokens, such niche little tokens that you only need one or two to consider that they're then present and, you know, have a presence on the list and, you know, they exist. That one or two is enough and that they don't need to be, you know, contemporaneous or anything like that. So the interesting thing about science communication is that this actually comes back to what presence of women is considered acceptable. Now, you would expect that if it were 50-50 kind of along the gender spectrum, that would be equality. But when they've done studies, what they've shown is that men think that when women speak account for about 15 to 17% of the conversation, that's equal. When women get to about 35, 37% of the conversation, they're dominating it.
Wow.
It's very interesting.
Yeah.
As a man in this discussion. Mm. And I'm not saying it's untrue by any mechanism. It's just, it's very interesting to hear.
And so, but this is the interesting thing. It's like, what is it that we're actually going for when it comes to, you know, what's the conversation that we want to have when it comes to what is acceptable amount of female presence? Because there seems to be a lot of insecurity when women start peeking up, when they start speaking, when they start edging that space on the public platform.
Mm.
And that's when you get the response, the backlash, the arguments that women are running things and things like that. So
I am running things.
That's true. No, you're doing a bang up job.
For this podcast, runs everything.
Yeah.
That is so not true. Collaboration is key. Raises thumb.
Indeed. I do want to talk about the term politics.
Yeah.
Or everything is political.
Yeah.
Which is kind of the way you think about things, isn't it?
And yeah, no, everything is political.
And I mean, we look at that from a Macquarie Dictionary point of view. It's tactical manoeuvring to gain advancement or favour.
Yes.
That's what it means, right?
Yes.
Do you feel like that's a little bit, I want to use the word Machiavellian or bleak, in regards to looking at humanity?
Well, the first thing I would say is that Machiavelli's The Prince was actually written as a satire and not as a handbook, and everyone's misunderstood that.
Great. Oh. Slap me down.
I was quite impressed that you threw that in there.
I know. That was off the bat, and I take it back.
No, it's little known. It's little known, and I am a wanker. And I'm just going to... I own being a wanker.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I feel like
it's all yours.
It's all right. Why wouldn't I? So the thing about politics is manoeuvring. Is manoeuvring a good thing or a bad thing? It can be both. It depends who is doing the politicking. You know? I mean, the only time we disagree with political manoeuvring is when it's against our politics.
It's true.
Yeah.
You know? Mm. You know, you look over at the over at America, they don't want government intervention in their lives until suddenly, there might be trans men in my men's room. Now I want you to come up with legislation.
Yeah.
So to me, actually, words are really fascinating because it depends on what you imbue them with.
Correct.
And so the wonderful thing is that words accrue meaning as they go on. Nice used to be an insult.
Really?
Yes. Nice used to mean bland. And it's kind of course.
Yeah.
And it's actually kind going of getting back there. Back there. Yeah, isn't it? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So and so I've got like Shorter Oxford's volumes.
Yes, I
up
see
there.
Your stack of dictionaries.
Impressive dictionaries you've got yourself.
I'm all intimidated from the get-go, really. Yeah.
But they've got etymologies for most words in there. And I love a good etymology because there's nothing more interesting than seeing how a word has progressed through the ages. So politics can move, politics can create change, and the only time it's really a bad thing is when it's subjective and we disagree with it.
But important that you have that.
Well, no, I believe, I believe I am in no way a libertarian who doesn't believe in politics or political rule or political intervention. If anything, I'm way over the other side when it comes to that sort of thing. So, I see politics everywhere in the world. And do I agree with most of it? No, that's why I talk about it. I mean, like, no one really wants to hear a story about, here's some really great political manoeuvrings that are happening that I'm really happy about. It's like, you only do that if they're rare.
Oh, and I just want to get to that point because I mention a lot about watching the news.
Yeah.
Right? And news stories are never happy stories.
No.
Are they? They're never happy because... Why? People love...
Conflict.
Conflict. But how does that change people's point of view and does that make them a more negative person? Does it make them a more fearful person?
Oh, yeah. Well, so what you...
I'm opening a can of worms here, aren't I?
Yeah, well, what's really interesting about all of that is that...
Good luck editing this.
Welcome to Amy Wafflin on.
I'll be in Bali. Yeah, yeah. Much love.
What's really interesting about the news is that you have a daily storytelling device that not only works on what people respond to, but it also works on their politics. Okay? So you've got maneuvering from there whilst, you know, from up above, whilst reporting on the political maneuverings of others. So that's quite the tadukken, you know, when it comes to what we get in our media. And so I'm sorry, I think I'm like contractually obliged to mention tadukken in every conversation I have. It's just the best.
Fair enough. Like me and the Lion King.
So, you know, people get editorialized versions of news stories. Are they really true all the time? Well, that's the part that we, you know, that would take longer to dissect.
Yeah.
You talk about in your story this idea of that you often use your life as a foil to explore larger issues.
Yes.
In acting, there is the idea that you bring yourself to every character you play. How essential is the idea of bringing yourself to each story that you write?
I think on a universal level, it is inescapable. But as a technique, it's something that ties into what is called the identifiable victim effect. So the identifiable victim effect is like if news or something happens overseas with people that we cannot relate to. Say, for example, we can relate to the Paris terrorist attacks, but we can't relate to the Indonesian terrorist attacks. Mm. Why can't we relate to them? Because they're, you know, they're a different race to us, they might be a different religion to us, there's different classes, things like that. We have a different tribal association. So we don't actually feel that connected to them, so therefore we then don't care about their story as much. That's how the theory works, and that's what a lot of people see with stories. That's why, like over in America, everyone will report on the white girl that's missing. They won't necessarily report on young women of colour. So,
well, it's like when the Je Suis Charlie thing happened and everyone was like, it's terrible that something like this has happened in the world. And it was legitimately terrible, but that those things are happening every day.
Every day. And like the other thing that is, you know, so like, and with that terrorist group, it's also really important to note they're killing way more Muslims than they are Christians or white, you know, white people over in Europe. But once again, identifiable victim effect. If we can't identify with the victim, we can't care about their story. So therefore, if that's the way representation is going to go, how do I then use myself as a means to explore issues?
To provide the connection.
Yeah.
Because people have to connect to what you're telling them to care about it.
Yeah, exactly. So a conversation with my daughter about gender representation becomes an essay about Julia Gillard's time in power and why she was, you know, vilified for her gender. I was walking down the street just today and I got really skeeved by two guys. And I knew that I could actually write from that. They were like pressing into me as I tried to walk by them. They followed me.
What?
It was, yeah, it was, you know, pretty skeevy. But I also knew, because writers are the vultures of human experience and emotion, like actors.
No, I was going to say, great, welcome. That takes the pressure off. Brilliant.
We're all at the table.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But like my first reaction was, I can use this in a story because I'm categorizing all the emotions and then I can see where all the input points are that relate to different politics. Okay, so
I suddenly have a lot of grave concerns about how you calculate our friendship.
I do want to change tone slightly.
Yes. Yeah.
And look, you mentioned that recently you didn't have a true mentor until recently.
Mm.
Jenny Diski, can we talk a little bit about how you met Jenny and how did she become a mentor for you?
Very informal mentor. So we've got to sort of say that like a formal mentor is a very, very fucking specific thing. Jenny died like the 27th of April this year after a bit of a protracted battle with cancer and some other issues. She was a fierce intellect and memoirist. She came to writing later in life. She was a bit of a foundling. And estranged from her mother, Doris Lessing took her in. The writer Doris Lessing took her in and looked after her and eventually convinced her to start writing, which Jenny did. And she ended up writing, you know, many books and was a columnist for the London Review of Books. She was on Twitter, and I don't know, somehow she and I one day started yelling to each other about Sherlock. Once again, it's me yelling at people on the internet.
And when we say yelling, yell tweeting.
Caps lock used at some point.
I really do. You have no idea.
You should try receiving an email from Amy.
Good. So no one really needed that sound effect, did they? But anyway, so she and I had bonded over what we saw as problems with the third series of Sherlock. Because we tackle the big issues, as you can tell. Mm-hmm. And I ended up writing an article about it, and with the greatest of trepidation and fear, like I felt like a child going up to an aloof mother with her drawing, asking to put it on the fridge. And I just sort of said, "Hey, Jenny, here's my article on Sherlock."
I wish we were videoing this.
Trying to be really, really like cash about it. Like, read it if you want. And then she then retweeted it to her followers, and then she sent me a couple of private messages, and she went, "You can write." And so, like, first things first, I fell to the floor in tears because I respected the fuck out of that woman. Also, I was afraid of her. Very afraid. But you know, like, and so she gave me all this praise, and then she said, "You should write for the London Review of Books." And then I really lost it, because like that's my ultimate place I want to write for. And so anywho, I like over the years she and I would tweet to one another, and she'd say, "Hey, that line you wrote about teens on public transport, can I put that in my column this week?" And it's like, "Yeah, sure, go for it." Or, you know, something like that. Or we'd discuss TV, or I would send her, once again, I would actually send them privately and not publicly, because I felt like I was actively hawking for a retweet or something like that, and I didn't want to. So I would send them to her via private message, and she would give me feedback and critique on them. And for a woman who, she was a very terse, taciturn woman in many respects, especially, you know, she loved a bit of a joke, but she, you know, she did have that very taciturn way to her. And yet, even with that mindset or that personality, she was incredibly generous, incredibly gentle in her feedback. And the great thing about her was that she would just sort of say, no, you're doing that thing where you're pretending to be a writer. Stop that, just be a writer. And so getting back to that authentic voice, you know, writing how you speak.
Yeah, like when we're acting rather than just being.
You'd be surprised how often, that happens in acting all the time.
Exactly. Yeah. So, getting to that authenticity.
So that's, I mean, that to me is something that's really important, this idea of having people in your life who are gentle or encouraging or who do provide you with fuel for your dreams so that you keep going forward, you know, because we work in these creative industries where there's so much pulling us down, even if from how to make money to support what we're doing to the subjectivity of the reaction to the work that we're producing. What do you do to stay inspired and cope with the stresses of your profession?
Turn off social media. So there's you've got to get, noise is a really interesting thing because you need it. Like, so for example, I actually need actual audible noise when I work because it helps sort of drown out everything else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so you need that. And then occasionally you can, you know, I might have like the news station on. And then that means that I can just sort of dip into it every now and then and find out what's happening. And then I can just shut out to it again. But with social media, it's such a drain, not only in terms of your time, but also in terms of your perspective. It can actually really stretch out your perspective in terms of you tend to think that conversations on Twitter or Facebook are representative of the entire world. They're not. There's
a bubble that you're in.
Yeah, and there's an amazing amount of research on Pew over at the Pew Center that just sort of show that, yeah, it is a bubble. So, you know, it's very easy to get sort of blown out by that or by writers' politics or things like that. The thing is, you've got to keep a relatively even keel with your mental health if you can, because what that does is that keeps your curiosity afloat.
Mm.
So it's curiosity that's actually the whole key. And also getting that balance with the noise, because the most interesting jumping off point for me when it comes to writing is when it's not actually from listening externally, it's more from listening to my head going, oh, I wonder what that means.
Mm.
Oh, I think that's something. That's when I know I've got something to work on.
Yeah, it was interesting that you mentioned shutting out social media.
Mm.
Because you are, I would say, fairly prolific on social media. You have over 49,000 tweets that have gone out into the world. And you have over 7,000 followers.
Yeah.
So I feel like social media is a big part of who you are in regards to your voice. Is that true as a statement?
My voice? Yes, it is my voice. It is my voice, but is it... I don't believe in branding or being consistent or only talking about one thing or...
So, what is the key to storytelling in 140 characters in your point of view?
Well, see, this is the thing. What are you trying to do? Are you trying to engage people? Are you trying to just send them off somewhere to have a read of something, or do you want their conversation? Like, you can just set up a story, no problems. You just go, and I've done this especially with rants, and you just say, all right, settle in. Mama's gonna get ranty. I've been kind of experimenting occasionally with doing like little essays or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
140 characters at a time.
Iambic pentameter?
Yeah. No. awesome. But I, you know, you just...
My next performance.
Yeah, exactly.
Was tweeted by Amy Gray.
It's all haiku. But yeah, you can just load it up in such a way where if they click one of your tweets, they can then see all the subsequent essay or points that you've raised.
Yeah, okay.
And so what do you want to do with that? You can just make a series of points about one issue and have them neatly kind of digested into, here's a bullet you can retweet, here's another one, here's another one, here's another one. Because it's not necessarily about what you say, it's about getting people to engage with it. And so that means changing their point of view or demanding action from others or just sending it out and amplifying it. Or you can tell stories with photos or things like that. And there are lots of, like, especially over in America and Canada, there's actually quite a few people who are doing really, really interesting things in terms of, like, Twitter essays and things like that.
Mm. Wow.
I didn't know that. I've got no idea with Twitter.
The podcast is on Twitter. We, you know.
But we struggle.
We're new age.
Yeah, no, no. Yeah, yeah. Hey. Yeah.
Oh.
What?
Maybe we'll have to book ourselves in for a little...
Yeah, Twitter lesson.
There's some interesting things. Look, the interesting thing about Twitter, and this is why I really love the internet, because it was the internet that gave me the access to the writing world, and that is the fact it's got a bit of the punk DNA to it.
Mm.
Anyone can access it. And if you stick around long enough, if you try hard enough, and if you are loud
you're saying, don't worry, guys, if you're really bad, you'll get there eventually.
And everyone starts off bad.
On that note, we do just have a few questions left for the interview. But before we get into our life questions, we would like to talk about the book that you are writing. Although I asked you about this before we started recording, you said there are 8 of them. I thought there was one.
Yeah, no, there's like 8 at the moment. There were like, there's a list of 8 and there's 3. Well, there's 2 that I'm working on actively.
Is one of those to do with Antarctica?
I'm doing planning for Antarctica. I'm not actually writing.
I think that story's amazing. Can you tell us about Antarctica?
So everyone knows that I hate people and I like the cold.
You know, mentioned that already in this podcast.
And if you don't know that, you do now. Yeah.
It's really part of what you might call my signature. That's what I bring. Anyway, Jenny Diski, she, you know, was receiving a few curly questions about her complicated family past. And she thought, you know what, I'm just going to book it to Antarctica. That sounds like the best coping mechanism I can, you know, enact at this time. And so she got on a boat. Well, she got on a plane, then she got on a boat, and she went to Antarctica. And I thought, well, you know, Jenny, this is back before, you know, when Jenny was still living, I think I should do that too. Because I hate people. I'm not fond of my family. And I like the cold. Also, there's no duty on cigarettes in Antarctica. So this is win-win.
That's a trifecta, right?
That's great.
Isn't it? It's what we call a win-win-win. And anywho, so I did apply for a grant with the Antarctic Arts Fellowship, but, you know, they don't have a history of giving any grants to writers. So I knew I wouldn't really have that big a...
Have they met chance. You? Do they know it's probably just safer to give you the money?
I know, right? They should just Google me.
Yeah.
So I've got all these pictures of me wearing T-shirts with Satanist on it and, you know, things like that. we're working out different ways at the moment to get over there cheaply and to write a book about, you know, write a book about Antarctica through really fresh eyes in a way that it hasn't been told about before in popular culture. So in popular culture, it's normally presented as it's a blank canvas or it's the ultimate enemy. So, you know, to me it's neither. It's actually like this amazing frosty Garden of Eden that I find incredibly fascinating.
And you want to go find the apple.
Yeah, pretty much. Spoilers, it'll be a cigarette. But also I think that there's actually a really interesting anthropology kind of research there in looking at how the age of exploration changed, because you had people like Amundsen and Scott, a bit of an arsehole, and then, you know, Shackleton going over there, and, you know, some of them were kind of really blustery. We are pioneers, we are explorers, we are colonialists, blah, blah, blah. This is all ours. We don't understand what we're doing, but we're British, so that's good enough. And then you had, you know, Mawson, who was a little bit more reasoned. Not much, but he was a little bit more reasoned. He understood technology and he was really interested in finding, you know, within his means, technological ways to be really researched and smart about his time over there in Antarctica and living there, because he lived there. And, you know, really he was one of the ones who came about with the Antarctic Treaty System, which was, no one actually owns this. No, let's not go and kill a bunch of fucking animals again. Let's approach it a different way. And so for me, that's actually a really fascinating thing. We have not explored that in any interesting depth whatsoever, and I find it fascinating. I would like to do that, and I would like to compare it with, compare it to how writing has changed. Because writing is changing. It's changing not only with market forces and cultural forces, but also technology. So it's, you know, there are a lot of similar elements at play with Mawson that there are for, you know, modern day writers. I want to find the connection. Good writing comes about not just from, oh, this is a great idea. It's actually working out why something is a great idea. It's a series of great ideas. And then it's finding all the connection points in between and braiding those fuckers together.
And so you finished this book.
No.
Right? No, let's just say. It's not finished yet.
Yeah.
But you,
cool,
you,
we're done with that. Yeah, yep.
So you finished this book. What does success look like for Amy Gray? In that, if that book was wildly successful, what would you hope be for the book, for you?
What's next?
You go on to other questions. That's what writing is.
Yeah.
It's what's a really interesting question in my head. I want to see how far I can follow it. And that's what I love about going to the bookshop. You go into the bookshop and there are all these, you know, nutbags with, you know, books. Like, I've got a book about the war that killed Achilles. It's just over there. And it's just all about the history of the Trojan War. And I thought, you magnificent fucking nerd. Yeah. That's what you wanted to write about. Say. Oh, I'm paying for that. Good for you.
I'm glad it's about that and not about my ankle.
Yeah.
Anyway,
Okay. We're getting towards the end now. Sorry. Sounds like you might have answered this question a little bit already, but what advice would you give to young writers who are just starting out in the writing world?
Right. Like, literally, there are the thing that actually kind of everyone wants a theory. Everyone wants, you know, give me the model that will make me famous, blah, blah, blah. No, motherfucker, sit down and fucking write. And do that for a couple of years to find out what your voice is like. You don't know what your voice is like immediately. Work on that. That actually takes some time and get used to it. It's a series of muscles that you're developing and that you need to strengthen. So go ahead, go write.
And if we look at your voice, Amy Gray, harking back to your years studying archaeology and ancient religions, if you could pick a myth from any culture to represent your creative presence in the world, what would it be?
You know, there's a story of Tantalus, which is where we get the word tantalizing from. And Tantalus had pissed off Zeus, or, you know, it's always someone pissing off Zeus, I'm sure. And he, you know, his punishment was just he had to sit in a river or a lake or, you know, whatever. It was a body of water. Let's not get technical. And there's a really lovely branch above him filled with gorgeous food. Whenever he was hungry, he would lift his head up to try and eat it. And the branch would just, like a jerk, move a few inches up and he couldn't eat. He would, you know, look down, try and drink some water. Ah, water went away. That's what it's like writing, trying to find the most perfect word, the most perfect sentence, the most perfect argument. It's frustrating, but it's really, really great.
Oh, brilliant. Thank you so much. I thought you were going to come up with something Japanese then. But no, some Japanese monster.
Oh, yokai. I love yokai.
Yeah. So just quickly tell Nick about yokai.
Yokai are amazing because they're very, so, right, they're monsters, but they're uniquely Japanese because they present Japanese fears. And some of them are, like, you know, just crazy. You know, these people gave us, you know, octopus porn. So, you know, things are a little bit out of the blue there, you know? You kind of sound like you've never heard of octopus porn before, so I don't know. Maybe that was too much for me to say.
I've been to Japan and I didn't see any octopus porn. But
yeah, you're not looking around the right places then.
Not living.
anywho, there are some like amazing like Japanese like monsters that relate to Japanese neuroses, like the faceless subway man. And he's dressed like your regular salary man, you know, like businessman, but has no face. And that ties in with that kind of anonymity, you know, one of the hordes, kind of Japanese neurosis. And then there are just crazy ones like a gigantic foot that crashes through homes and says, "Wash my foot." And everyone has to wash the foot before it goes away again.
Yeah. Fantastic.
Because Nick's been to Japan recently.
Yeah. I just don't know where to go with that.
That's amazing.
Not the Japan you experienced.
Well, no, a little bit, to be honest. I think that is the Japan I experienced. But
that's
probably,
the thing.
I didn't have a name for it.
If there is no way to actually fully understand Japan, you can sit down, you can read and love their myths, love their stories, love their history, but just sort of accept that you'll never really get to know it.
No, that's so true. Amy Gray, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, it's been so wonderful. Thank you, Amy. I feel like my brain is useless. After that particular interview, I feel like, what is my brain worth?
It was fantastic. There was one point that I actually took out of it that really stood out for me, and it was...
You took one point out of
that?
No, I took many.
I have so much respect
that you managed to, like, grab onto something and just lift it out of there.
Choosing one, right? So okay, here's my
show
one.
Show off, go.
It was around mental health and the importance of mental health. This idea that you have to keep your mental health at a level where it keeps your curiosity afloat, because that's the key to everything, really, isn't it? Especially if you're a writer, if you're an actor, it doesn't matter, whatever it is. Curiosity is at the heart of it.
It was really interesting hearing Amy talk about when you're writing that idea of experiencing the trauma. So it was quite different to, as an actor, when we play a character that has, I guess, qualities that we don't embrace, it's about not judging that character and living truthfully inside of it and then letting it go. And if you, I guess, do the work properly, then there shouldn't be any trauma associated at the end of it. But of course, as the writer, you don't get to identify completely with that character. You, I guess, unless it's there a role, a character in a fiction that you're writing, you don't get to identify with them. You have to objectively look at them and how they align with your opinion. And yeah, I found that really interesting. I'm not sure that I can mention it. This is really just a cover for me not being sure that I can mention a takeaway.
There was a lot.
Okay, I'm just going to go with my general impression of that whole interview. And I know Amy quite well and I have a lot of respect for her and I know she does a lot of amazing things. And I've read her writing and one thing that I've always been conscious of knowing her and that I think comes out particularly here is how massively intelligent she is.
Yes.
And that through the perspective of her own life, she chooses to be so brave and to use that as a way to have a conversation to move society forward, or not move us forward, not even move us forward, but open society up. And I think if there is anything that we can do as storytellers, then that is what we should be doing.
Got some recommendations for me?
Funny, I do, Lauren.
It's like
I do.
Such a proposition. Come on, out
it
with
is,
them.
Isn't it? Yep. Okay, now I've got a brilliant one. Can I just, far out, this is so good.
Wow.
if I don't say so myself.
Yep. Okay, breathe.
Breathe and just say it. So obviously Vivid is on at the moment in Sydney.
Yep.
From the 8th to the 19th of June.
Oh, I remember you talking about this last year.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, awesome.
However, something brilliant is happening and it is called Björk Digital.
Ooh.
So obviously the amazing artist Björk is bringing her virtual reality exhibition to Carriage Works.
Get out. That space is amazing.
So Carriage Works is amazing, full stop. But what Björk has actually brought is just stunning. So she has a new album come out called Volnicura. And I really want to say that in Björk's voice. Are you ready for this?
Please listen to Volnicura.
That's pretty much how she speaks. But she's an amazing artist. And she has divided Carriage Works into five really unique spaces. Now, for those that don't know much about virtual reality, it's coming along in leaps and bounds. Like, there's some amazing things happening. So she has literally taken her album, taken a bunch of amazing filmmakers and programmers from around the world and created these different virtual reality experiences.
When is this on?
For her different songs. This is on in Carriage Works.
Yeah.
From the 8th to the 19th of June.
Oh.
And there's a couple of really interesting ones I want to note. So the first one is Mouth Mantra, and it's directed by Jesse Kander, and it basically transports the viewer to an extraordinary place, which is inside Björk's mouth as she sings the song from her album Volnicura. So imagine that. You put on your glasses, you're inside Björk's mouth. Insane, right? As well as that, there's heaps of educational stuff going on. So you've got Biophilia, which is a big hands-on educational space that she's got there, which showcases all her really innovative apps and custom-made musical instruments, because the whole thing is with Björk is she just makes instruments out of anything. She has amazing surface technology, you know, touch pads that make sounds, and it's just, I can't wait. I'm actually going to go to this in the next couple of days and I might report back on it because it's just...
Oh, absolutely. I can't wait. I'd love to. I wish I could experience that with you. That sounds amazing.
She was actually here doing DJ sets for the opening of it. So you've missed that, unfortunately, if you haven't already attended to it.
But you've missed that too by the sound of it. So I don't feel too bad.
You needed to book in for that. But here's the kicker. The best thing about it all, it's free. So if you're in Sydney, go along and check it out.
That is an awesome recommendation, Nick.
Thanks. I'm pretty excited, Bailey. I'm almost as excited about your recommendation. What is it this month?
Sneaky bugger.
What have you got for me, Bailey?
Oh, okay. So this is where Lauren admits that I have no idea what is happening in the world. In the world, outside of this room, pretty much. So I don't have a concrete recommendation for things to see or experience. And maybe once the course is, maybe I'll post my recommendation mid-month on the website or something when I come up with something more useful than this. But my recommendation for the month ahead is wherever you are to stop and breathe and take in the world around you and reflect on what you need for yourself as well as what you want to give to other people and to work from that place.
Well, thank you, Yogi Bailey. That was fantastic.
Oh, God, it is a bit like that, isn't it? And so, I don't know. I don't have, as I said, I'm not sure of what work is happening back home at the moment. But, you know, I'm here. There are some other, I'm working with Stephen Wiley is also doing the PhD with me. He's from Perth. He studied at LaSalle. And Kyle, I'm not sure of Kyle's surname, but another Australian is in the course. So it's actually really interesting because the students from LaSalle that I'm studying with here are from all sorts of different cultures and often cross cultures. There's a guy whose heritage is German and Singaporean and Malay and all different cultures. So it's actually really interesting to work in that environment because people think in, like, it opens up your imagination in different ways, I think, to when you're working with people who experience the same culture that you do.
For sure. Yeah. For sure.
Yeah.
And so, okay, Bailey, let's talk about how much longer are you there and what's the rest of the month hold for you?
Yesterday was the middle of the course and I think there'll be a fair bit of shifting left to happen before we're through. As part of the PhD work, are devising a performance. So we'll perform that at the end of the course. And then shortly after that, I come back to Melbourne.
Yeah.
Get a little bit older.
Oh, 32.
Actually, I get older while I'm here, but I celebrate it when I'm back in Melbourne.
Yes. There'll be a cake ready to go.
Yeah, I think, as I said earlier, this idea of before you go on a trip anywhere, there's that it becomes a deadline and a bracket and an end of things. So you're like, I've got to do all this stuff before I go. And so everything speeds up. And then you go wherever you're going and have that whole experience. And then that obviously shifts your perspective. And then you come home and you're starting from a completely different place. I mean, you clearly had a significant experience like this recently in Japan. And when you come back, what is that starting point? And I am really excited because last year when I came back from Bali, I really felt centered, but it didn't last. And I had a bit of a meltdown and wasn't sure what I was doing and was quite stressed and unhappy. Mm. So for this year, my challenge is to come back and work on how to sustain that and bring that into my creative life. And the other thing that it does is, as you can tell from all this stuff I'm talking about opening up, I feel like the closer I got to leaving, the more I was thinking about money and practical logistical things, which I really feel narrows your vision. So when I come back in a strong place as a performer and have discussions with people and talk about new possibilities and really start creating again.
And I think that's going to be the key because, let's be honest, we all have those pressures that narrow our vision. Like money is something, you know, it's part of society, right? So it's something that we have to deal with. The beauty of where you are right now, it probably feels a little like a vacuum. And so how do you take that feeling and then but also integrate these other elements
Absolutely.
Of society
so
that it's harmoniously working together?
You know, yeah. And what about you?
Yeah, so the month ahead, you know, it's such a busy time in my life right now. 2016 is pretty crazy, and I feel like I say that a lot, but this is probably more from a personal or a life's journey perspective. I think what you've just said in regards to your month probably resonates strongly with what I'm trying to work through at the moment too, still to this day in Sydney, is how I manage all the pressures of everything that's happening, whether it be, you know, my corporate work versus, you know, and I haven't really spoken about this on the podcast, but getting married and, you know, we're getting a dog and, you know, so there's all these like life, and I wouldn't call them pressures, they're all wonderful things, but how do you balance
getting married and getting a dog pretty wonderful.
Oh, it's wonderful. Exactly. But it's all things that need to take focus as well as, I guess, where I'm going as an artist. So, yeah, I don't want to say balance because I feel like that's a cop-out, but it kind of is.
Well, I mean, balance to me, when you talk about balance, the image you get is of scales, one, two, like this over this, but it's more about, now I see pizza dough. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's more fluid than that. How do I navigate through it and keep the things that are true for me present? How do I stay true and present and open so that the important things will come up and be dealt with as they need to, and I continue on my through line?
Yeah, and that is managing the anxieties that come with many things, if that makes sense. And staying open is the key, because the anxieties of those can close you off, right? And then you're not dealing with anything correctly.
Yeah, and also, but also when you feel that anxiety, going, okay, what is that? And what do I need to give myself not to feel that way?
Yeah.
What can I give myself?
That was a good little therapy session from you there, Bailey. I will pay you handsomely for that.
Awesome.
By the hour.
I might need that when I come back from Bali.
Oh, what a good note to end on.
Yeah.
Lauren Bailey, it's been a pleasure to talk to you because, you know, we haven't caught up for ages with you being in Bali.
Yeah.
And thank you, listeners, for listening to us. I know it's a bit of a longer podcast this month, but I'm sure you appreciate all the goodness that was Amy Gray.
Oh, I feel like, yeah, so much has been covered this month. It's fantastic. We love you for listening. We hope you are doing awesome things in the world.
You can find us on the usual channels, the website, About Me, Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, iTunes. We're everywhere.
Thanks for listening.